the president and foreign minister of Iran killed in a helicopter crash.
The charred wreckage of the aircraft was found early on Monday after an overnight search. Raisi's death was confirmed by Iran's vice president on X and on state television.
Plus, the International Criminal Court issues arrest warrants for the leaders of Hamas and Israel.
Well, they're accused of the most serious crimes, war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's what the ICC looks into.
And later, an update from Kyiv, a new president in Taiwan, and a thwarted coup in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Today is Monday, May 20th. And this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The president and foreign minister of Iran were killed in a helicopter crash on Sunday. That story coming up in a few minutes. First, though, the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for the leaders of Israel and Hamas. Karim Khan is the ICC prosecutor.
I can also confirm today that I have reasonable grounds to believe, on the basis of evidence collected and examined by my office, that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant bear criminal responsibility.
The top leaders of Hamas were singled out as well.
My office submits that there are reasonable grounds to believe that these three Hamas leaders are criminally responsible for the killing of Israeli civilians in attacks perpetrated by Hamas and other armed groups on the 7th of October 2023. The taking of hostages and the other crimes alleged in our applications.
For a deeper dive, I'm joined by our UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir.
Well, they're accused of the most serious crimes, war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's what the ICC looks into. In terms of Hamas, the court is saying that they have reasonable grounds to believe that the group carried out murder. They took hostages, which is a war crime. They carried out rape and other acts of sexual violence and tortured people. And in terms of the ongoing hostages of the in the context of their captivity, they're saying they're being subjected to other inhumane and cruel acts that are a crime against humanity. So serious crimes, but also against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Minister of Defense Yoav Gallant. In regards to the potential of famine in Gaza, they're talking about the starvation of civilians as a method of warfare, which is a war crime, causing them great suffering and serious bodily injury and harm, the willful killing of civilians, the intentional direction of attacks against civilians as a war crime, talks about persecution and extermination. So very, very serious charges against both.
So what happens next? Can an army of a third country go into Israel and find Netanyahu and bring him to justice, or find Haniyeh somewhere and bring him to justice?
Right. So these are arrest warrants. And as we know, the prosecutor's request must still be approved by judges from the court. But this certainly will put the government of Mr. Netanyahu under more international criticism for the way they've been prosecuting this war. So visually, you know, optically, it's very bad for Netanyahu. In terms of arresting him, you know, there are, I think, 123, 124 countries that belong to the Rome Statute. So in theory, he could not travel to those countries. They'd be under obligation to arrest him. But the International Criminal Court has no police force of its own, Interpol, you know, like it doesn't have its own sort of security guys who would go and arrest someone if they crossed a border. So it's a bit tricky. We've seen other people with arrest warrants against them, like Vladimir Putin of Russia. He's been traveling. Nobody's arrested him.
So it's something you said struck me. I hadn't realized before. You said that these are warrants that the prosecutor has generated, but it would still be up to the court to decide to try these people?
Right. So there's still a longer process. This is the very first step. They're saying that enough evidence exists for warrants of arrest before the pretrial chamber, and then the chamber, I guess, will decide how to go forward with the charges.
What typically happens? How long does it take? What will the process be?
Well, it can take years. I mean, for instance, we've seen in Sudan, the International Criminal Court opened a case in 2005. It was referred by the Security Council, the situation in Darfur at the time of genocide. And it took years for them to collect all the evidence and statements and to bring charges against individual members of the Janjaweed militia and eventually against President Omar al-Bashir, who was then a sitting president in Sudan. It was the first time the court brought charges against a sitting president. And they didn't issue an arrest warrant for him until March of 2009. And it's worth noting he's still not been arrested and we're in 2024.
So it sounds like what you're saying is the people affected by this, the leaders of Hamas, the leaders of the Israeli government, this might be bad public relations, but personally, they have really very little to worry about at the moment. Nothing's going to change for them tomorrow.
Correct. And I think, you know, we've already seen that it's affected them. It's affected their feelings about it all. I mean, for weeks now, we've been hearing that the court was going to indict or bring charges or arrest warrants. And the Israeli government has been very vocal about it, very angry about it. We've seen congressmen and senators in the United States who are very pro-Israel saying this is outrageous. If it happens, we will sanction the prosecutor. And by the way, the U.S. government has sanctioned the prosecutor previously. So, expect them to make good on that. And today, the Israeli foreign minister put out a long statement about it, saying how outrageous these charges are and how politically motivated they are. And they're beyond outrageous and they're emboldening terrorists by, they're very upset about the fact that Israel, a democracy, has been put sort of on the same line as Hamas, what is recognized in many countries as a terrorist group. They don't like that at all. And they say any attempt to draw parallels between these, quote, atrocious terrorists and a democratically elected government is outrageous and cannot be accepted by anyone.
VOA's Margaret Bashir, our UN correspondent in New York. Margaret, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this morning.
Thank you.
Iran is mourning today following the deaths of President Ibrahim Raisi and Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian. They were killed in a helicopter crash in foggy weather conditions and mountainous terrain, officials and state media said on Monday, after search teams located the wreckage in East Azerbaijan province. Reuters' Gabe Singer has the story.
The charred wreckage of the aircraft was found early on Monday after an overnight search. Raisi's death was confirmed by Iran's vice president on X and on state television. President Raisi, the foreign minister, and all the passengers in the helicopter were killed in the crash. Rescue teams fought blizzards and difficult terrain through the night to reach the crash site in East Azerbaijan province in the early hours of Monday. Raisi had been at the Azerbaijani border to inaugurate a joint dam project. There has been no official word yet on the cause of the crash. State TV halted regular programming on Sunday to show prayers for Raisi being held across the country. The 63-year-old was elected president in 2021. Since taking office, Raisi had ordered a tightening of morality laws, overseen a bloody crackdown on anti-government protests, and pushed hard in nuclear talks with world powers. Iran's dual political system is split between the clerical establishment and the government, and it is the supreme leader rather than the president who has the final say on all major policies. But for years, many have seen Raisi as a strong contender to succeed his 85-year-old mentor, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who has strongly endorsed Raisi's main policies.
I mean, I think a lot of people might celebrate or might be happy, but also a lot of people, I think, naturally would be very worried as to the potential political stability and what it could have.
A contest to replace Raisi may already be in the works, according to Arash Azizi, an Iran political analyst at the Center for Middle East and Global Order.
We all expected a ferocious struggle for power to begin after Khamenei dies. It might have already begun with this incident.
The crash comes as Iran faces pressure over its nuclear program, its military ties to Russia, and its connections to Hamas, which is fighting Israel in Gaza. Countries including China expressed concern over Raisi, while the White House said U.S. President Joe Biden had been briefed on the situation.
Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us today. And for a look at the death of President Raisi and what it might mean for Iran's relations with Israel and the West, my colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Seema Shine. She's head of the Iran program at the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University.
I'll tell you the truth. I don't think the Israeli government has to respond on that or to give any announcement. At the end of the day, it's an internal Iranian issue. And from Israel's point of view, the way I see it, it doesn't matter if it is the president is Raisi or Kalibaf or Shamkhani or someone else. From Israel's point of view, the policy of Iran against Israel is so profound that it doesn't matter exactly who is the president and what his name is. So I think this event has a lot of meaning in other respects, but not directly to Israel.
What do you think the meaning of this event, the death of Raisi, will mean for Iran's long-running conflict with Israel, which of course escalated dramatically last month before calming down again?
Yeah, that's right. I think that the issue of Israel in Iran is across the camps. It's not that one side, you know, the more moderates or the more reformists or something think differently. Israel is perceived to be an enemy. There is a ideological anti-Israel base. It's very, very strong feeling. And of course, the last event did not improve this tension between Israel and Iran. I think at the end of the day, we know that strategic issues are concluded by the supreme leader of Iran. And the president is important, but not as a decisive element. It's one of other voices. I think the IRGC in this respect is more important than the president.
Well, speaking of Iran's president, you'll have the first vice president, Mohammad Mokhber, serving in that role until Iran has a new presidential election under its constitution. What kind of election process are you anticipating in Iran, and who do you think will emerge as the next president of Iran?
So the issue of the next president of Iran, I think, is an important and a major issue for the supreme leader in Iran, because he understands that the one day he will be electing, because it's not democratic elections, the one he will select actually, will be the one who will be very important for the succession issue in the future. And from that point of view, that's one of the troubles that he has now with the event, with the passing of Raisi, because he decided Raisi is the one that he could count on. He will not have his own independent policy. So it is very important for him to find someone who completely adjusts to the position of the supreme leader and doesn't have his own independent voice. It's a difficult issue now. I don't know if one of the candidates, the names that we hear now, suits completely to this definition.
So given what you said, do you expect much change in the Iranian government's long-running antagonistic approach toward the U.S.?
No, I don't see any chance for a huge change. I do see a decision that was made several years ago and was promoted very forcefully by Raisi, and probably will be the same with the next one. And that is the policy of detaching themselves from the West and from Europe and putting all their assets and all their hopes in the flourishing relations between Iran and Russia and China and North Korea. What we see in the last 2 years in the Ukraine war is a very, very tightening relations between Russia and Iran, and this is not going to change.
VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Seema Shine of Tel Aviv University. And now we turn our attention to the war in Ukraine. It's a day of mourning in the Kharkiv region following a weekend of deadly Russian attacks. Moscow's renewed offensive in Ukraine's war-ravaged northeast is adding significant pressure on Kyiv's outnumbered and outgunned forces. VOA's Lori London gets an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Sounds like there was some very serious attacks over the weekend. What can you tell us?
It was a very tough weekend for Kharkiv and Kharkiv region. The city of Kharkiv is under constant shelling, as it was for the past couple of months. Unfortunately, there are more attacks across the area and across the region. Over the weekend, it was a really bad shelling of the recreation area in one of the villages in the Kharkiv region and also the surroundings. And at this point, we know that at least 11 people were killed, including a woman who was 7 months pregnant. Also, at least 28 people were reported wounded. Unfortunately, the city of Kharkiv is also suffering from the shelling, and particularly the central part of the city. And this includes residential area and also recreation areas such as cinema that was heavily damaged over the weekend, and also some, you know, cultural facilities around it. I had a chance to talk to civilians who live in the Kharkiv region. They say that over the night, they experienced really heavy shelling.
Russia's advances in this region is really forcing Ukraine to send in reinforcements and stretching its troops along the front line in the east and south.
Yes, a lot of experts believe that this is the main reason for Russian forces to start this new offensive in the Kharkiv region, that they that the main aim is just to get forces that could strengthen Donetsk region from there and to move them to the Kharkiv region, because, of course, Ukrainian forces experience quite a big deficit of manpower, especially in comparison to Russian forces.
Right, and since Russia launched this new offensive, there are obviously, as we've been talking about, fears about it coming very close to Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city. My understanding is over the weekend, a divisive mobilization law in Ukraine came into force. What can you tell us about it? And has there been any signs of anything changing or reaction?
So the new mobilization law is now in action, and Ukrainian men have 2 months now, 60 days to be more precise, to update their personal information in the military facilities or through the new online applications that was also launched over the weekend. So now, according to the data available on Monday, more than 300,000 men have already updated their personal information through this online service. And basically, Ukrainian military authorities now have all the information they need in order to proceed further with mobilization actions. Again, experts believe, and a lot of people inside of Ukraine believe, that this will help to bring more people into the army. However, there are a lot of concern in terms of the organization of the process, and a lot of people also require and ask the authorities to not just provide this online service, and because it's really the service that can help to make the process easier, but also to provide more and better training for people that will take into consideration of people's skills, and this also should help to encourage and to improve the mobilization action here inside of the country.
Anna Chernikova reporting for us from Kyiv. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.
Lori London hosts Flashpoint Ukraine here on VOA. She was speaking with our correspondent in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Taiwan has a new president. We'll get the latest in a few minutes. But first, the Democratic Republic of Congo says it stopped an attempted coup on Sunday. Here's Army spokesman Sylvain Akenge.
The armed forces of the Democratic Republic of Congo inform our citizens and the international community that an attempted coup d'etat has been nipped in the bud by the defense and security forces. The attempt involved foreigners and Congolese. These foreigners and Congolese were put out of action, including their leaders.
Akenge says that some 50 people have been arrested, including 3 American citizens, and that the leader of the operation has been killed. A Reuters reporter said gunfire rang out around 4 a.m. in the capital, Kinshasa. Akenge said armed men attacked the presidency in the city center, and that another attack took place at the nearby home of Vital Kamerhe, a member of parliament who is expected to become speaker. Akenge named the leader of the attempted coup as Christian Malanga, a U.S.-based Congolese politician. A live-streamed video on Facebook showed Malanga inside the presidential palace shortly before he was killed by authorities. Malanga is seen railing against President Felix Tshisekedi and his ally, Kamere, who is the suspected target of the reported second attack. Tshisekedi was reelected for a second term in December, but has yet to name a government. The U.S. ambassador in Kinshasa, Lucy Tamlin, said in a post on social media that she was very concerned by the reported involvement of American citizens and that the embassy would cooperate fully with the authorities in their investigation. The United Nations Stabilization Mission in the DRC said that its chief condemned the incidents in the strongest terms. A court in London has ruled that Julian Assange can appeal his extradition to the United States. The AP's Charles Della Desma has more.
After the hearing and among jubilant fans, Assange's wife Stella said the US was pushing ahead with the case, but now should acknowledge it's time to quit.
The judges reached the right decision. We spent a long time hearing the United States putting lipstick on a pig. But the judges did not buy it. The United States should read the situation and drop this case now.
High Court judges Victoria Sharp and Jeremy Johnson ruled for Assange after his lawyers argued that the US government provided blatantly inadequate assurances that he would have the same free speech protections as an American citizen if extradited from Britain. I'm Charles de la Desma.
On Monday, the newly sworn-in president of Taiwan, Lai Ching-te, asked China to stop its military and political threats. Reuters' Sekir Jasny has the story.
Lai Ching-te took office as Taiwan's new president on Monday. He was sworn in at Taipei's historic presidential office, succeeding Tsai Ing-wen after serving as a vice president for 4 years. Lai said in his inauguration speech that peace is the only choice and that Beijing had to respect the choice of the Taiwanese people.
The future of the Taiwan Strait plays a decisive role in the future of the world, and as the people who take over the democratic progress of Taiwan, the new government will steer peace and maintain the status quo, being neither overbearing nor self-effacing. I also want to call on China to stop threatening Taiwan politically and militarily, to take on global responsibility for the maintenance of peace and stability, and to ensure the world is free from the fear of war.
In attendance at the ceremony were former U.S. officials, lawmakers from various countries, and leaders from some of the 12 nations maintaining diplomatic ties with Taiwan. Lai said that people must be realistic about the threat posed by China, and the island must show its determination to defend itself.
We have the ideal to pursue peace, but we must not have illusions. As long as China does not give up using force to invade Taiwan, citizens must understand this. Even if we accept all of China's claims and give up our sovereignty, China's ambition to annex Taiwan will not disappear.
China did not respond immediately, despite previously labeling Lai a separatist. Since his election victory in January, Taiwan has faced continuous pressure from China, including frequent Air Force and Navy activities near the island. Beijing sees democratic Taiwan as part of its territory and hasn't ruled out using force to bring it under its control. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken congratulated Lai, saying the United States looked forward to working with him to maintain peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait.
That's Sekir Jasny of Reuters reporting for us today, and that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.